We're going to talk to clinical child psychologist David Coleman, who is in our Limerick studio. David, it's still time, as I say, for on 51551, maybe for one last query, but here's one about children and jobs around the house. I'm the youngest of five, and when I was a child, my parents expected us to help around the house and later in the family business. I have two small kids and I'm a stay-at-home mother while my husband works long hours. I think the kids should help out with chores, but he reckons it's slave labour and that it will rob them of their childhood. He's okay himself at doing housework when he's home, but the bulk of it falls to me, and some days I could cry if I have to wipe the table one more time.
Good morning, Sean. I can imagine that the mum is absolutely tearing her hair out, particularly if she's not getting much support from her husband with the concept of the children helping out at home. I think it's critical that the children help out at home. I think every child should grow up in a family where they have an expectation that they're going to do their share of the general family chores, whether that be filling up the dishwasher, making beds, putting clothes into the laundry, whatever it might be. Because I think if we don't do that, we run the risk of not giving them a chance to build their self-esteem, and also critically, not giving them a chance to build resilience.
Indeed. Now, we don't know from this, Mum, what age the children are. So I suppose there's a level of chores that you could set out for different age groups.
There is. And she said that they're small kids. So, if we take that they're perhaps still preschool age or early in primary school years, in truth, they're not going to be a huge amount of practical help anyway, because what the mum will find, as most of us do, is that it actually takes more effort sometimes to get our children involved in the chores. And particularly if we want the job done halfway well, then we're probably going to be not just assisting, but ultimately probably doing it. But it's not the fact that we do the job or that we give them a lot of help that's important. It's the fact that they feel that it's part of their responsibility. Because if a child is to develop resilience, then they have to realise that, getting themselves out of the difficult situation that they're in is their responsibility, that there's nobody there going to rescue them, nobody there who's going to do it for them. And I think if we don't expect children to do small household chores in their early years and right through their primary school years, even into their secondary school years, then they're going to grow up probably with a sense of entitlement, which is not going to be helpful for them.
I mean, stuff like, as you say, loading the dishwasher, the washing machine, whatever, setting the table. Perhaps. Why? What about things like preparing simple meals, like being able to make a scrambled egg or beans on toast?
For sure. And I think any child who's in primary school should be able to make the bulk, or if not all, of their lunch for going out to school. It's not that complicated to put some filling between two slices of bread if that's your typical lunch. It's not that difficult to take a piece of fruit out of the fruit bowl and put it into a box. So I think, again, it's about the parent's attitude, though, more than it is necessarily about what the children actually do. And I think, the dad in this situation, to see that in some ways his kids helping out at home is slave labour, I think really misses the point of what chores are about. It's not about the volume of work that they're doing. It's just about the fact that they are actually taking some sense of responsibility for what has to happen.
Here's one about an older teenager. My 17-year-old son, who loves soccer and plays with the local club and wants it as a career in some way or other. However, sometimes he feels his clubmates are not taking it seriously. After matches, he can be very upset and angry, even if they win, but he thought he didn't play as well as he could. He doesn't leave the dressing room until last and is very angry at himself and can't talk to anyone as he feels he will explode. He reacts the same after training if he feels the training didn't go well, and he gets really upset and depressed. The whole family is walking on eggshells and he won't speak to anyone for nearly 2 days. What can I do to help him?
Well, he certainly needs some kind of help, because, I'm all for competition and I'm all for young people having, a clear goal or expectations for themselves. If they don't set expectations for themselves, they're not necessarily going to be trying to strive forward or push themselves on. So I think it's good that he has those things. However, setting those expectations has to be realistic, and he also has to be fair and somewhat compassionate to himself if he doesn't feel he meets his own expectations. And I think, some of what he needs to learn perhaps is how to do this for other people so that he can then learn to do it for himself.
It's a team setting after all.
Exactly. And so, if that's his attitude towards his teammates as well, that whatever about, his frustration at himself and his crossness with himself, I wonder, does he direct any of that kind of crossness to his teammates? Because I can't imagine that they're going to be willing to accept it for too long if he does. And so has he learned the skill of a little bit of empathy or a little bit of compassion when his teammates perhaps haven't performed as best they could? Or again, does he become very critical and harsh with them?
Maybe he's another Roy Keane in the making, though. Somebody who just is a bit of a perfectionist and won't take anything less than 101%.
Yeah, well, perfectionism is fine, but it leads to high levels of stress and anxiety. And so all of us need to learn how to temper that perfectionism, because unfortunately, as humans, we're bound to make mistakes. That's the nature of humanhood, our humanity. So I think if that's the case, then, you know, it's about how do his parents also help him learn to make mistakes and to learn to be compassionate, to learn to forgive. And again, you know, they don't talk too much about their own role, but, you know, somewhere along the way, he's learned to internalize this kind of harsh, kind of perhaps critical expectations. And so again, you know, there might be something for the family to look at, well, what's their own general sense of how they approach different situations. But certainly it's really important that the parents do talk to him about how he is, rather than leaving him be and this sense of kind of walking on eggshells, because at some level he needs to process what's going on. He needs to be able to try and make a better sense of it.
My 2-year-old daughter is obsessed with her fingernails and her toenails. She's at them all the time, picking, picking, picking. I bought her a onesie and she nearly lost the plot. She kept saying, "Where are my toes? Let out my toes. It's awful, but how do I get her to stop?"
Yeah, so I'm guessing that the daughter is doing that in some way as a form of self-soothing or self-comforting, or just pure habit at this stage. But she's only 2, so there's no question, I think, of the mum trying to approach this in a rational way. I mean, if ever we try and deal with really strong kind of self-soothing habits in children, you know, one of the ways to approach it is what they call habit reversal therapy, HRT. And that's all about finding an alternative habit that the child can do that is less damaging, destructive, or harmful to themselves. So good that the mum introduces a physical block, you know, so if her feet are covered up by the onesie. Similarly, if she was going to bed wearing mittens that were kind of, you know, clearly put on her that she couldn't easily take off her, that would be a way to interrupt it. Again, when it comes to toenails and stuff, you know, if she was, you know, the stuff when you bite your fingernails, there's a kind of a paint that you can put on the fingernail that just tastes really horrible. Again, if she was to coat her child's fingernails with that as well, it might just be a little bit aversive, because even though she's picking with her fingers, ultimately those fingers are going to end up in her mouth, because that's the nature, again, of 2-year-olds. And so that might also be a bit of a kind of a push for her to stop. But ultimately, the mum has to interrupt the behaviour and then try to get her to do something else instead. So finding something else that she can be distracted by or engaged by instead of the picking at her fingernails. So keeping her fingers busy, getting her to do something that involves, you know, using her fingers, whether that be some kind of drawing, painting, you know, whatever it might be, that'll just keep her fingers busy.
Here's one that's just come in on the text from Fiona. I have twin 11-year-olds, a boy and a girl, and the girl is such a liar, it scares me. How can I make her more aware and stop this? She's very secretive.
So there are a number of reasons that children will lie to us, and often it's because they may be afraid that if they tell the truth that we're going to be very upset or cross, or they could even be afraid that we're going to be disappointed or in some way shamed at whatever it is that they've done. They may also want or need to lie to us to protect other people and to protect harm coming to other people as they perceive it, that we're again going to be upset or cross, or somebody else's mother is going to get told about something that happened. So there are a lot of reasons, I think, that are quite natural for children to lie. Again, you know, I think it's not unexpected that a child would lie to us, but the sounds of it, from what that mum is saying, it's the volume or the quantity of the lies that are really upsetting her with regard to her daughter. There's, I suppose, an element that you can bring into it, which is about, you know, choosing your battles. Which lies do you really want to pursue in terms of, you know, pointing out to your daughter that actually that's not the truth? Because I think at some level she does need to hear that certain things are a lie and that's not okay. But perhaps not every single lie that she tells needs to be challenged.
What about sanction, David?
Again, you see, you have to be very careful with sanctioning children for lying, because what ends up happening is that it's not necessarily the issue that you're sanctioning them about. So say, for example, they're lying about where they were or what they did or who broke what or who started a fight. You know, if this sanction becomes about the lie, then, you know, the actual issue, the problem that you wanted to address in the first place might get lost. And so, you know, the sanction should be about the inappropriate behaviour, perhaps, that she's lying about, more than about the lie. Because I think, as I say, that the lying is possibly quite a natural response for a child who just doesn't want to get into trouble. And so maybe if they felt that there wouldn't be much trouble, that actually it's more in their interest to tell the truth, because that way things just progress easier easier and life gets easier as well when you tell the truth.
We've two to go. We'll try and do them briefly. My younger child is 7 and he has severe dyslexia. We're thinking of switching schools to one with more support for him. We've got good advice. We've spoken to the principal in the new school and I think he'll do better there. He'll stay where he is until June and then move into third class in the new school next year. The other school is not too far away. I have also got an older child, a daughter in fifth class, and my question is, should I move her too to the new school along with her brother? She has not been diagnosed with dyslexia, but she's not the strongest at maths. Would she benefit from a move as well?
Possibly she might benefit from the move, but I think you know this is a real dilemma for the parents and one that they're probably just going to have to do a quick cost-benefit analysis of. You know, what are the costs of moving to the new school for the older daughter? So it might be that she's really missing out socially, or she will miss out socially in terms of having to move to a new school where she'll be there for just 1 year before she goes to another school again. So that's quite a lot of disruption over a 2 year period. The benefit might be more to do with the fact that, you know, practically for the family, it's easier. You know, it's easier to bring two kids to one school than to bring two kids to two separate schools. Although when she goes to secondary school, they're going to have to cross that bridge anyway. So I think some of it is about really sitting down with the daughter and talking with her about the potential costs and benefits and seeing what would she like to do. Because she is of an age, if she's in fifth class, where actually her opinion is probably really valid.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of stuff about friends and all the rest of it that have to be considered. David, thank you very much. The clock has caught us again. We have another query here. To, we'll bring them to you the next time you're in studio. Now, it's just a minute to 11. We'll take a quick break.